Genes and environment in asthma.
Contraceptive use and Zika preparedness.
Identical twins and their health.
And combating alarm fatigue.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on August 5th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't start talking about Zika right now. That's as reported in this week's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, with a couple other facts embroidered on there.
So this takes a different approach to looking at Zika infection, and specifically about preparedness, because we know that it is transmitted by mosquito bites. We also know that it's spread by sexual intercourse as well. And in an effort to be better prepared, as you know, it's now been reported in the U.S. endogenous infection, that is by mosquito bites, in the Miami area. So we need to decrease the number of mosquitoes that are infected. What about people that have infection either from the U.S. or from outside and come in and transmit it to their partners, preventing unintended pregnancies? Because the Zika virus is associated with microcephaly, brain abnormalities, behavior abnormalities, and hearing problems and growth deficits as well in young infants. What CDC attempted to do was to look at the 41 different states that are predisposed to having mosquitoes with the Zika virus in them. So, and ask a simple question: how prepared are we with regard to contraception? They looked at three different surveys: adult women that have been surveyed, women who just delivered that have been surveyed, and high school women. And what they discovered was their use of long-acting reversible contraceptives was very low. And in fact, there was a significant number of women in all groups that weren't using any contraceptive. The vast majority were using what's considered a suboptimal contraceptive, and about 41 to 50% of pregnancies are in fact unintended. So this suggests we're really not prepared, not only with regard to fighting the infection, but also to preventing unwanted pregnancies in women that could potentially be infected with the Zika virus.
Of course, worldwide, we've also seen a rather sad uptake of contraception in women who are at risk. And I specifically refer to Puerto Rico.
Yep. And there are a number of different reasons. Some of it's cultural. Some of it is access issues. A lot of it's just information. Because in this study, the low-income women still have access because of federal funding for the long-acting reversible contraceptives. But still, their use is incredibly low.
Certainly something to be concerned about. I think also we need to add to that the fact that this week the CDC issued for the first time a travel warning for someplace here in the United States.
And that was in the Miami area, where there have been at least four cases that are tied to infected mosquitoes. And by the way, the CDC is doing screening around the United States, detecting what percentage of mosquitoes actually have the Zika virus. But this was the first time we had documented transmission from the mosquito to individuals.
The good news, of course, is that it does appear that there are some pretty effective vaccine candidates that look like they're almost ready to be used. Let's turn from here then to the New England Journal of Medicine, something I served up as understanding genetics and the environment with regard to the manifestations of asthma.
This was a fascinating study, in my opinion, Elizabeth. We've touched on this before, and that is the observation in different populations that children that are exposed to animals, particularly to farm animals, early in life, have a lower incidence of asthma and allergies. So what this study did was they took a relatively homogeneous genetic pool, individuals that had come over from the same areas in Europe to the United States. But since coming to the United States, they migrated to different areas, and these populations have maintained many of their social habits or lifestyles. These would be the Amish that are primarily based in Indiana and the Hutterites of South Dakota. Both came from the same part of Europe. They largely have the same lifestyles, the same number of siblings. They have the same rates of vaccination, same diets, low rate of childhood obesity, same breastfeeding, all things that are known to affect allergies. But the difference is, although both of them are farming communities, the Amish have very traditional small farms. The Hutterites have these large commercial type farms. As a result, their exposure to allergens is very different. What the study did was that it looked at, first of all, is the incidence of allergic reaction and asthma in the Amish versus the Hutterites. And in fact, the Amish had a 6 to 8-fold lower incidence of having asthma or allergic reactions. When they looked at the dust, they had a much higher exposure to dust with particular types of chemicals called lipopolysaccharides or endotoxin. So it appears that this exposure triggers an innate immunity in the Amish that protects them from having asthma. You say, well, that's theory, but they actually proved it. They took these same allergens, exposed mice to them, and when the mice were exposed, they also had a lower risk of allergic type reactions, except for those mice in which the innate immunity response was not normal. They had an increased incidence of asthma as well. So it looks like it's exposure to particular allergens, activation of the innate immunity system, and protection from asthma.
I just love this. I think it's an amazingly powerful and creative idea to take a look at these folks who had a very similar genotype and then being able to dissect out this very specific exposure between the two populations.
You know, normally we try to do this statistically, correct for confounding things or different variables. And I agree with you. The novel thing about this is how they did it. So I'm glad you picked this particular study.
I think it's so much fun. Besides that, of course, it may identify something that could be helpful for the multitudes of children, specifically all over the world and here in the United States, who do develop this very troubling asthma that sometimes is life-threatening.
This suggests that activating the innate immunity system, certainly early on in childhood, can be protective, especially for those individuals at risk. So this, as you mentioned, may have some therapeutic implications.
We'll be watching. Since we're talking about people who are closely related, let's turn to JAMA Internal Medicine. Something else I thought was really fascinating, a look at monozygotic or identical twins separated at birth. And hey, what happens to those folks later on?
We know that obesity is a major risk factor for both cardiovascular disease and death, but the extent to which genetic confounds this association is really unclear. So these investigators looked at over 4,000 identical twins in Sweden that had discordant BMI. And that is identical twins, one of whom was heavier than the other. And then they looked at their death rate over the course of the next 12 years and their incidence of developing diabetes. So what they discovered in these individuals, average age of about 58, is their incidence of death and MI was no different between the heavy and the light or the lean twin. But the risk of developing diabetes was higher in the heavier twin. The more discordant the weight, the higher the likelihood that the individual would have diabetes.
And this is, of course, really interesting to me, because the questions I would ask about this study are, what does this tell us about the impact of diabetes on the development of cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular events? And then I would say, let's look at longer term follow-up with regard to this.
That's a very good point, because once a person develops diabetes, they don't develop the complications for another 10 or 15 years. So it may be that extending this study shows that there is a mortality difference between the two. The other thing I would mention in this particular study, because they're Swedish, they didn't have really obese individuals. A small number, about 15%, were obese, about 40% overweight. As you know, in the United States, we have a large portion of our population which is obese and some that are extremely or very obese.
So your prediction is that if there were more people who were in the morbidly obese category, we would have seen a much greater impact on mortality.
I think so.
Finally, then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Hey, if we want to monitor people who have heart disease, can we send them away remotely and allow them to be monitored in that way?
So I'm going to frame it a little bit differently. It's not sending the patients away, but it's sending the information away. And originally when I saw this title, it talked about off-site central monitoring of patients that would normally be in a cardiac telemetry unit. These patients have monitors on where we monitor their heart rate, frequently their blood pressure and other vital signs. That's usually sent to a nursing station. Now, unfortunately, what's happened is when all the patients on a particular floor or ward, that information is sent, every time there's an abnormality, an alarm goes off. And only in about 0.2% of those alarms is it associated with a life-threatening condition. Most of these times, it's a false positive alarm. So we have what's called alarm fatigue, and they're ignored. And if you ignore all the false positives, oftentimes you'll ignore the true positives as well, and it could be harmful. So when they teased this study up about off-site monitoring, I realized it's a way to get the alarms off the floor and into a central site where somebody's looking at them continuously. That's their job. And if they see something abnormal, they can contact the nurse on the floor. And what they discovered was this off-site monitoring was pretty effective. About 80% of the time, they were able to identify abnormalities about an hour before an emergency response team was activated. There was no higher risk of these individuals needing CPR. It reduced the number of patients put on monitor by about 16%. The use of standardized cardiac monitoring off-site was just as effective as having it in the room, and in fact, a lot less annoying to the nurses and doctors involved with the patient's care.
Well, I guess that would be the part of it that I would hone in on, and that is, does this practice reduce staff fatigue?
Well, they didn't address it in this particular study, but I'd be surprised if it didn't. I mean, if you've been on the floor, these alarms are going off all the time. People seldom look up anymore because of that particular reason.
We'll see more extension of this, I'm sure. That's my prediction. This week on the blog, I'm going to talk about those folks of, I'm going to call it Germanic extraction, who emigrated to the U.S. and were able to avoid the development of asthma. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.